Welcome to Motivated to Lead podcast, helping you become a better leader. I'm your host, Mark Klingsheim. Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining us for our podcast this week. My name is Mark Klingsheim with SEMA Partners. Each week, we interview leaders and they share lessons learned from their careers. Our goal is to help you become a better leader. This week, we're going to revisit an early podcast that we had an interview with Jason Malad, who is a CEO of Start Codon, which is a company that is working in the area of providing better patient outcomes. He has an interesting personal story, grew up in Louisiana and ended up going to Cambridge University, got a doctorate there in medicine, and then moved into the entrepreneurial world. He's got some great lessons that he has learned in his career and around entrepreneurship as well as leadership. Looking forward to revisiting a conversation with Jason. I guess first off, Jason, can you just give us a little bit of your background, your career, and your story?
Sure, and thank you for having me. So essentially, I was born and raised in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, in the very deep south. Lots of great food if people haven't been down there, you know, good music as well. But I always had a passion for science. My father was an animal geneticist professor at a small black university called Southern University in Louisiana. And my mother was a social worker, but also an entrepreneur. So she had a lot of different businesses from the moment my brother and I were born. She wanted to do things like she sold cosmetics door to door. She had a physical therapy clinic, a pharmacy, you name it, travel agency. My mom did it. Could never sit still. So I always tell people I'm kind of a blend of the two of them.
Sure.
And I quite early on knew I wanted to have a career in science. And so when I went to university at Tulane in New Orleans, I double majored in biology and chemistry, so did two bachelors, and I had the option to go to medical school, but I was really passionate about the early research that goes on in the lab. So I'd worked in the lab many years. I was encouraged to pursue a PhD. I was awarded a Marshall Scholarship to go to Cambridge in the United Kingdom, and I completed a PhD in a cardiovascular medicine topic. But after going through my PhD, I also learned that academia was not for me, so sure. I better figure out how I can still pursue science, but more the entrepreneurial side of my spirit that I inherited from my mom. So the mixture of the two is what led me to biotech, and I kind of went through a non-linear path, ended up in tech transfer at the University of Cambridge, and one of my mentors there told me about getting out into the world of biotech to gain more skills. Most recently, I was at a company, Cambridge Epigenetics, which I was CEO of for 2 years. And now I am trying to pay it forward, running my own accelerator, finding other young companies and young founders to support them in their own journey. So that's kind of my career to date.
Yeah. Well, it's quite a journey from Louisiana to Cambridge, and that's a great story. Well, tell me a little bit. You've been in the startup world, and I didn't realize that Cambridge is as much of a startup community that you guys rank with, you know, Stanford and some of the other world-class universities. But tell me a little bit about some of the things that are going on there and some of the things that you're working on.
Yeah, it's really interesting because Cambridge is a small place. The metropolitan area, I would say, at a stretch is maybe 130,000 people. Yet in between 2013 and 2017, a study just came out saying that Cambridge University spinouts raised more venture capital than even the spinouts from Stanford in the like period. So it makes you wonder how such a small, quiet place with cows in the pastures, the kind of cobblestone streets and things like that, sure, is able to punch above its weight. And so it's a perfect combination of a very international community, the University of Cambridge, and this increasingly entrepreneurial spirit that we have here. So in many rankings, people say that Cambridge as an ecosystem is third behind Stanford and MIT in terms of output, but it's still a relatively sleepy town. And I love that combination where you can meet world famous professors or CEOs of companies or their amazing teams, Nobel Prize winners, just having a coffee down the street.
Sure.
Because it's such a small place. And that also means that if you have a dream to be an entrepreneur, to have your own startup, it's relatively easy to get access to those mentors and leaders to help you on your own path. And that makes for an excellent environment of highly skilled scientists, really enthusiastic people, and easy access to both capital as well as these elder statesmen, as it were.
Very cool. Yeah, it's kind of interesting as you look at kind of the landscape of, you know, a lot of the universities are doing accelerators. And I think the one that you're part of, is it 50 companies, or I was reading some of the background, or how many companies are you working with currently?
So up to 50 companies over the next 5 years. We're just
getting started. Yeah. Got it. Well, that's exciting. If you were, and this is one of the questions that that I ask every CEO, every leader that comes on the podcast, and you're closer to this age than the question is, what would you tell a 22-year-old Jason starting out? And you're closer to that age than most of our guests. And I said, you know, most of them are a little bit more seasoned, which means old. So it's great to get your perspective, because you've done some great things since you've graduated, but you're on the front end of your career versus kind of the mid or the later stage. But what advice would you give a 22-year-old Jason?
Good question. The first thing I would say is, don't worry. Don't be so anxious. You will find a path. You will be able to figure it out. So that's just a general thing I would have told myself at 22 years old. The next thing would be to go where the science leads you. I mean, one of the great things is, it doesn't matter if it's here in Cambridge or one of the other known hubs. It could be in Tulsa. It could be in Toronto. It could be maybe even somewhere in Africa or parts of Asia. Go where the science that you're passionate about leads you, and you will figure the rest out. Because things are so international and global now, you don't necessarily have to be in what's already been recognized as a leading hub. You might be a big fish in a small pond. So although Cambridge has done, I adore it here, and it's my home, and it's my home for the foreseeable future, and I'm really bought into the ecosystem, there's no reason why 22-year-old Jason in Louisiana wouldn't have been able to find his path in the science and maybe even build a biotech company in New Orleans, for example. So, and the third thing I would say is, it really does come down to your network. Mm-hmm. So the sooner that you can meet people who have had success and are ready to mentor you and open doors for you, the better. For too long, I thought I'd have to go it alone because I wanted to be self-made. It's like, no, I'm going to have to do everything from scratch myself. But in reality, along my entire career so far, it's been down to the people who reached out and helped me to help me get to where I am. And that's why I'm hoping to do that going forward for other people. But not to be afraid to ask for help. The worst anybody can do is say no.
Right. Absolutely. That's great advice. Well, we talked a little bit about kind of how we connected, and it was actually an earlier guest on our podcast, Grace Colon, who had introduced us. And talk a little bit about mentors. You talked about connecting with people that can maybe have already been where you want to head, and just the importance of that.
Yes, Grace is a perfect example. She is near and dear to my heart, because not only from a professional standpoint, but also personal, Grace has been a fantastic person helping drive me on my journey, and she continues to encourage me to achieve more and do more, and also open doors. When I first met Grace, it was because she had invested in my company, Cambridge Epigenetics, and she flew over from California and spent a couple of weeks with us in the trenches here in Cambridge, just really trying to understand and help us realize what the true value of our technology was. And that was key, because we were on one path, which, fair enough, was adding value, was bringing science to academic research, which is great. But she said, well, what is the future? How are you going to translate that into positive outcomes for the clinic? And because she had actually been on that journey and was in the midst of it running her own companies at the same time, she could credibly help us map out that business plan. Mm. So it's one thing to have, say, a consultant who can tell you the theory behind it. It's another to have somebody like Grace, who's actually done it and has done it multiple times. Mm-hmm. And has seen it from different levels, both from an investor standpoint as also an operational CEO. So that is invaluable. So it really, you need to have people like her who can help you see the forest for the trees, as they like to say here.
Sure.
See the bigger picture. That can also open doors for you as well. She introduced me to Vern Norville, someone else I think would be great for your podcast. He is the head of the IP office for, IP practice rather, for Wilson Sonsini, based in Palo Alto and San Francisco. Fantastic. And so Grace had known Vern for many years, introduced us to Vern. He helped us with our fundraising. He helped us turn our patent portfolio around, which was instrumental in changing the company. And the introduction came immediately from Grace. So she was able to connect me with other people who could help me go to the next level and the next level. So you really have to have those graces in your life in order for you to reach your true potential.
That's good.
It's absolutely essential.
So now you're kind of, you're paying it forward at an early stage. You're helping other CEOs and people that have great dreams and visions of what they want to accomplish. What are some of the things that you tell them? What are some things that you coach as you're talking to them?
You know, it's funny. The first thing I tell them is that being a CEO is not what they expect.
Right.
I usually say, it's like, don't get enamored with the title. If you want to be a CEO, it costs you like 10 quid to register a company's house here, maybe another five, like 15 pounds to set up a website. Go on LinkedIn, call yourself CEO. Okay, good for you.
Yeah,
right. So don't get so hung up on the title. Get really bought into the function. And I said, fundamentally, you start off as a jack of all trades or a Jane of all trades, depending on who I'm talking to. And you have to do so much to get your business up and running. But as you expand and as you bring in more venture capital, your job really is fundraising and finding and building a team that you enable to be successful. It's less about you doing everything yourself, because that's not sustainable. It's more about building a team around you that you then support and bringing in the funding to help them support them to get done what needs to be good done. You set the higher strategy, but it really, that's the role of the CEO, the strategy, the fundraising, and a lot of it's HR and support. Mm-hmm. So if that's what resonates with you, then you're on the right path. And if not, then maybe you're not the right person to be CEO, but you might fit in another role, and you have to be very self-aware and honest. The other thing is figuring out what your plan is and actually accessing capital. So a lot of what we do is helping people figure out their fundraise, what's their fundraising strategy. What's their business plan? And then how do they build their teams? Because ultimately, as an investor, you invest in the team first and foremost. So it's really trying to piece all of those aspects together. And our accelerator provides capital and guidance. So we actually provide investment for equity, and we also provide guidance and connecting with our mentor network.
Got it.
Help that become a reality.
So what lessons have you learned around putting together a leadership team? What are some things that you've learned in the past number of years?
I say go for compatibility, but don't look for people who just are in an echo chamber with you. Mm-hmm. Because you need someone who will challenge you. And it's about bringing the right skill sets. You need to be able to harmonize as a team, but you need people who will challenge you as well. Because often you make the wrong decision, and we've all lived it and seen it, just because everybody in the room is so vigorously agreeing with one another. Oh, aren't we great? We're so clever. That's a great idea. Yeah. Oh, well, everyone in the room agrees. It must be wonderful. Get the person in the room who is going to tell you the truth.
Right.
Not being naysayer or being negative, but just someone who will say, hold on a second. Maybe this isn't the best idea, or maybe we need to pressure test this a bit more and embrace those people. Some of the best colleagues I've ever had in my whole career so far have been the ones who have not been afraid to tell me exactly what's on their mind and back it up in a constructive, critical way. And often you end up meeting in the middle, and it's a much better decision than just me saying, oh, well, it's my decision, it's my way or the highway. I would never do that. I want to be surrounded by people who will pressure test even my own ideas and vice versa, as long as it's in a constructive way. So you've got to find team members who bring a skill set, who bring that knowledge and expertise, but can also challenge you in a good way.
So the people that you have, and it sounds like you've had people that have really helped you in your career and given you outside guidance and maybe have taken you aside and said, hey, Jason, here's some areas that you maybe are not seeing. How important is it to have kind of that personal advisory for, especially if you're in that top position within an organization, even if it's small, to have those people, you said, to challenge you? Do you intentionally have that group of people that you go to on a regular basis?
I do. And it's funny because those are the ones I, in some ways, hold the most value for me. Mm-hmm. The ones who always tell you, you're doing a great job.
Right.
That's nice. You know when to approach different people. So you got to have the ones who will just lift you up when you're just feeling down. And those are your friends. That's great. But you need also those people who will be critical in a professional and personal way. And I think one of the challenges we have here in Cambridge is that there are a lot of enthusiastic people, particularly enthusiastic young people, who are first time in business and a lot of first time CEOs. And so what we have, and I benefited from this, is a network of the more experienced to come in and either be maybe chair of the board or CEO coaches to help take you through and support you as you grow. So it's not just about finding serial entrepreneurs who've been CEOs multiple times and multiple exits. Those are hard to come by on this side of the pond. So we take them and we put them as non-exec directors and chairs of multiple boards of these startups. So the young CEOs who have that talent but just need that close guidance can get it. And the more experienced can still keep their fingers in multiple pies so they don't have all of their expertise just devoted towards one opportunity. So a large part of what we do is finding these young teams, identifying someone we think could be a great leader, but then finding an experienced leader to mentor them, say, a day or a week or so. And we find that's a really good model where we don't have access to the same number, amount of talent or senior talent as you would in the Bay or in Boston.
Yeah. Around the area, and I think it's one of the things that you mentioned that a lot of people don't get, the fact that the CEO of whatever company is going to be the chief fundraiser also. What lessons have you learned as you've gone out to raise funds, and what advice would you give somebody that's in that position?
Oh, yeah. I say that surprisingly, there's a lot of capital out there. There's a lot of money to be had, particularly as Asia opens up more. And even in the UK, there's a push for international investment from American VCs, et cetera. So, and vice versa, a lot of British VCs are now looking overseas in the States. So there's a lot of capital to be had. You've got to choose strategically who you want to back you. What are they bringing to the table? Mm-hmm. It's not just for you as a startup to go out begging for money. You should also quiz the VCs. What are you going to give us? Because there's capital to be had. And I think often startups undervalue themselves because they think, oh, these people have the money, so I've got to really, really beg for it and give them what they want to say. Actually, know your worth. Don't be cocky or arrogant, but know your worth and say, well, you know, I have options. So are you going to help me with strategy? Are you going to introduce me to people? Are you a corporate versus a traditional institutional VC or an angel? How much of your time and your resources and network can I benefit from as opposed to just your capital? Because in many cases, what a company needs more than anything are those resources in that network, not just a check for $500,000 or $5 million. That's nice, but what else comes with it? Mm-hmm. The other thing would be start early. I always joke that as soon as you're finishing the last fundraise, you need to be thinking about the next fundraise. This is what takes up all of your time. So, you just told your Series A. Go out and celebrate. Have the weekend off. Now get back on the road thinking about the Series B. And many people who are new to this, they get shocked. It's like, what do you mean? No, I've got money for 2.5 years. I'm good. I don't have to think about this. It's like, oh, little do you know. And the key for that is building those relationships early and understanding what the investor for the next round will want to see. Not just pleasing your existing investors, but if you have a great Series A round, who's coming in at the Series B? Map that out and then engage with them and say, what do you need to see from me in a year and a half, for me to come back and convince you that this is worth investing? And then go away and try to address those and keep in touch. When we did our fundraisers, we would regularly have at least quarterly meetings, or even if it was a phone call or email update, with the investors we were courting for the next round. So by the time you get to that 6-month window when you're running out of cash and you're really going out and pitching, you've developed a personal relationship, because VCs love a good personal relationship more than anything. So that's what I would tell people to do. Start early and don't think that you have to beg for the money. Make them justify why you should take their capital as well.
Great. No, that's great advice. So what you're close to the research and what's going on and trends in life sciences and healthcare. What are you excited about? What do you see as far as some of the trends and things that are on the horizon that are energizing to you?
Oh, yeah, really good question. I'd say that I'm particularly keen on platform technologies. And what I like now is that a lot of things that were, say, premium back in the day are now becoming commodities, like sequencing, for example. And in a world where next generation sequencing is commoditized, you open up a whole new ecosystem for startups and ideas, because suddenly sequencing might become de rigueur and become affordable enough that everybody has it done. So it's interesting now that we have AI, we've got next-gen sequencing is so affordable. We have all these game changers, which means the whole next generation of companies and innovations will be possible in a way that they weren't before. I met with a company a couple of days ago working on synthetic biology, and they're telling me they think in 10 years' time, you'll be able to synthesize from scratch whole genomes, custom-made and highly accurate, for whatever purpose you like. And I challenged them, and I said, oh, that's really exciting, but as you're saying, in 10 years, it'll be a commodity. So what kind of new industries will pop up when we can synthesize genomes from scratch? And they sat there and went, oh, we don't know. We need to think about that. And then we started brainstorming, and I thought, oh, yeah, you can synthesize bacteria that can break down waste, and you can synthesize cells that have novel function for infusion, for cell therapy, and all kinds of cool applications. Mm-hmm. So that's what I find exciting. What is the world going to look like now that these core technologies are affordable? And the other thing I would say is I like the intersection of tech. So as an accelerator, we're interested in therapeutics, diagnostics, digital health, and med tech. So quite broad, but all healthcare focused. And the most exciting companies to me are combining at least two of those. Whereas in the past, it used to be a silo, like I'm only a digital company or I'm only a therapeutics company. We're increasingly finding people overlapping, and that's where you get real interesting play. So for example, if you have a novel medical device that can sample a novel biopsy and then put AI on top of that for early detection of cancer, that's a really cool combo. Instead of saying, I'm just a medical device company or I'm just a diagnostics company.
Very cool. Yeah, that's going to be exciting to see how that, and it's changing so rapidly. Like you said, that you got to think about not what you're developing, but what's coming down the road after that. So any books or things that, there's so many things, the volume of material that's out there but any books that you would say, hey, I'd definitely put these at the top of my list for a new or upcoming leader.
There's one that's my go-to, and it was one I read many moons ago. It's called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. Any little book. And basically the whole premise is don't try to ignore your fears or say, just convince yourself that you're not going to be anxious. You should feel it, embrace it, and then get on with it. And it's something that my parents taught us as kids is that, I'll give you a good anecdote. When we were younger, my dad would always give us math problems to keep us out of trouble and keep us engaged during the summer. So we'd have spelling words and math problems and book assignments and all sorts because he's quite the professor.
Sure.
And at one point, my friends would always be playing around outside. And I remember I just had the biggest strop. And as they say here, threw my toys out the pram. And I was really upset. And he said, okay, listen, you can complain now and then do the work and go out and play. Or you can do the work and go out and play. Either way, you're going to do the work. So it's up to you. I'm reading my paper. I'm fine. Right. And I remember sitting there. I must have been about 7 years old. And I thought, oh, he's right. I might as well just get on with it. And so Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway is a great, it gives you some tools for being like, okay, I'm afraid. What if I don't succeed? Or what if I don't get the funding and all this? It's like, that could all happen. So that's good. Now go ahead and get on with it. And I think that's the best learning. So many people just don't know how to get started or they're afraid to get started. Once you get past that hurdle, you just have to figure it out. Just go. And I think that's too often people, they get paralyzed with those doubts and concerns. Get over that hurdle, you'll be fine.
Right. Well, I have to ask you this question. What was the biggest adjustment moving from Louisiana to Cambridge?
Well, three things. The weather.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. So we're sitting with snow coming down today. I was just talking to you about that. And so we know.
Well, exactly. Considering how the first time I saw snow was when I came to England and I had to call everyone and say, it's snowing outside. And I guess it was only about an inch of snow, but for me, it was
sure.
And I had to learn about electric blankets and hot water bottles. And first couple of weeks, I slept in my wool coat because that's all I had. And I learned about thicker blankets. It was a whole thing.
Whole new world.
Whole new world. The others was the food, obviously, because we have really good food back home. But culturally, it's very different here. I came from a world where you say hi to strangers and you can be loud and a bit crazy. And in Britain, things tend to be a bit more reserved. So that was an adjustment.
Sure.
But I've embraced it. It's been several years. I'm now a dual citizen.
I've got
my family here. And yeah, I love it. And I like to think that I bring a bit of Louisiana kind of crazy, as I call it, to England, and the people have been embracing it.
Oh, good. Oh, that's a great story. So tell me, outside of work, it's important to have other things that you enjoy doing to recharge. And tell me a little bit about outside of work, what you enjoy doing.
So I get my energy from people. So I spend a lot of time with friends and family. I have my fingers in lots of different pies because there are lots of things I'm interested in, but I get bored easily. So I mentor a lot. I find that to be enjoyable. It actually helps me relax. I'm sponsoring, I'm a patron of a new theater company here called Bread Theater and Film Company.
Okay.
And they're trying to bring more diverse playwrights and acting roles to Cambridge because most of what's done here is very classics, very Shakespeare focused. They want to kind of modernize things. And I thought that was really exciting. So I helped mentor them. I have a cocktail bar, spend a lot of time there.
Okay.
It's called The Lab. Yes. So myself, a physician named Peter, and one of my really close friends as well, Tony Kazarides, who's a professor and an entrepreneur here. And it's The Lab because it's about celebrating science in Cambridge. So we have famous scientists. We have cocktails named after people like Stephen Hawking and other Nobel Prize winners here in Cambridge. Although Stephen wasn't a Nobel Prize winner. He was quite the figure in Cambridge. And it's a place where on Friday, it's networking for VCs, for people from the biotech industry, and it's just a lot of fun. So I spend a lot of my time there as well.
Very cool. And I know you have a new son that you've added, so I'm sure that takes up a lot of your time too.
Yes, he is my number one priority. He's the biggest challenge I've had.
Yeah, that's great.
8 weeks old today.
Yeah, well, that's a lot of fun, and it brings a lot of definitely it's enjoyable but tiring, I'm sure.
Yeah, very.
Yeah, well, give us a little bit, maybe some parting advice that you would give if you were to sit down with somebody. What would you kind of parting advice would you give them?
I guess parting advice would be kind of a summary of some of the points I made is that you shouldn't be afraid to get started. Make sure you surround yourself with people who will be constructive and critical at the same time and can help introduce you to others. And basically, know your worth, but also know that no path is completely linear. It's not if things will change, it's when they change. And it's how you deal with that change that matters the most. I think most investors out there will say the same. They're investing in you as a team for that reason. They're expecting that there will be challenges and problems. They want to see that you're agile and that you can roll with the punches and quickly get up and move. And finally, don't be afraid to fail. If you're not failing at something in life, you're not trying hard enough, is what I say. So really, you just have to go for it. And most people in this world don't. And that's the difference between, I think, the successful individuals that we might idolize and the ones who just let opportunity pass them by, is just go for it.
Great. Well, thanks, Jason. This has been a lot of fun. I've enjoyed our conversation and you've shared some really great insights and definitely wish you success in your ventures there in Cambridge. And it sounds like you have an interesting life and a lot of other things going on. So it's been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. And I hope you can come visit me sometime and I'll treat you to a cocktail in my bar.
Thank you for listening to the Motivated to Lead podcast. Please subscribe on iTunes. You can also see a video version of this interview at motivatedtolead.com. This podcast is brought to you by SEMA Partners, helping you find your next great leader.